Welcome to the Fanboy Strike Back Comic Review Podcast, episode 59.
Hey, and welcome to the Fanboy Strike Back Comic Review Podcast. I'm David.
Eric.
And we are the Fanboys to Strike Back. Every week, most weeks, we come and we talk about the comics that came out. We pose a little challenge to one another. We pick up a book that the other one probably wouldn't read, and we do a little counterpoint session. We talk about those, and then we discuss a few choice books from that week. There are going to be spoilers in this podcast, so if you don't want to be spoiled, you may want to pause the podcast and come back later. And then also, in this episode, we're going to give you our review of Street Fighter 4. And Eric has seen a little comic movie that just came out called The Watchmen. And he's going to tell us what he thinks about that. But that being said, Eric, I picked up Batman Cacophony number 3. Is that how you say it?
I believe so.
Okay. By Kevin Smith, Walter Flanagan. And I heard that you didn't pick this up.
I stopped after the first issue. This series, apparently I made the right choice, because first issue was just not good.
Yeah.
And the thing is, okay, the big announcement came out, I believe it was, was it San Diego or somewhere?
I think it was last year in San Diego.
Yeah, that Kevin Smith and Neil Gaiman were going to start writing Batman books, and then, oh, Eric was excited. And, 50% ain't bad. What Kevin Smith really, really lacked, Neil Gaiman made up for in spades. So I will gladly take the Neil Gaiman book and just forget the Kevin Smith book ever happened, which is sad. I don't know if it just really was a bad book or my tastes are maturing or a little bit, but I'll tell you why I didn't like it, which was I felt the story was mediocre. The Batman Joker thing I've seen done a million times better before that, and also I felt just like the dialogue for the Joker is off. It almost became too much like I was reading Kevin Smith. Like, the dirty jokes were in there. There was sexual, not even innuendo, but just, like, downright, like, okay, we're going to make sex jokes. And that's all good and fine. I love Kevin Smith stuff, and, I laugh at it just like anybody else. I've been doing it for a long time. But it just felt a little out of place here. Like, it kept taking me out of the story. And it wasn't as prevalent and stuff that I've read from him before, like Green Arrow. I didn't feel that at all. Occasionally there'd be like a Kevin Smith joke, but it was so few and far in between, and it fit within the context. Within this, there was no good context for it, and the art was mediocre at best, I would call it. So have you been reading the whole series, or did you just pick up this?
No, I just picked up this last one. So this was number 3 of 3. I have no idea what's going on. Apparently there's some kind of villain or anti-hero who's kind of trying to kill other heroes. And it opens with him about to... It opens with Batman fighting the Joker, and this hero or anti-hero or villain, I don't know, they never really said his name, he shows
the
up.
Guy?
What's that?
Is it the sound guy? Like, he makes a noise and he says it and the noise happens? Like, he has a bullseye on his... face.
Yeah, he has, like, some kind of bullseye on his face.
Well, Kevin Smith, I think it was Kevin Smith, introduced him in the, or maybe it was Brad Meltzer. He was a Green Arrow villain back in the early Green Arrow series.
Okay, interesting. Well, okay, so he shows up, and he tries to take down Batman. It doesn't work. Bruce kind of takes him down. And to get away, the guy basically puts his knife straight through the Joker's heart. So the Joker's on the brink of death. They're on the rooftop. Commissioner Gordon and some of the Gotham police show up, and Batman, holding the Joker, says, you know, he has a choice. He has the choice of going after the villain or saving the Joker. And he ends up choosing to save the Joker. And I thought this part was actually really good, because Gordon comes up, and Gordon's like, what's going on? And Batman's like, the villain's gonna get away. Don't know the guy's name. I can't chase him. I have to save the Joker. And Gordon looks like him, like, are you an idiot? He's like, just let him die. And Bruce is like, I can't do that. And Gordon's like, you know, I know you have your one rule, but you did not do this. You did not put the knife in his heart. You did not kill the Joker. I mean, think about how many more people are going to be better off without him. And Gordon's like, just let him die. And does a flashback of all the things that the Joker's done and what he's done to Barbara. And it has a brutal... I mean, I think you said the art was mediocre at best, but I thought the art was really good in this. And there is a brutal page where it shows the Joker beating Jason Todd with a crowbar. Just brutal. Mm. But Bruce ends up saving the Joker anyway. So
see, that kind of flies in the face of the whole conversation they had in Hush, though, too, where Batman was... He was killing Joker, but at the same time, Gordon made the exact opposite statement, and Batman said, like, how many more lives are we going to let him ruin?
Right.
And so I just feel like it's...
I feel like reading this, it was... I thought it was good, but I do... Even I was thinking that the roles would have been reversed. Like, it would have been Bruce saying, okay, just let this happen, while Gordon would have been, you know... Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think... It could make sense either way, and it was a good read, but I don't know. I think there's never anything at stake. You know either way, they're not going to let him die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the Joker gets put in a coma. Bruce puts on a disguise and goes to talk to the Joker. And I think this is where I don't know how I felt about this. It comes into the whole them needing one another, and... I think at this point, Bruce just got way too sensitive and way too emotional, because Bruce basically goes to the Joker and says, you know, do you really want to kill me? And the Joker is like, you know, to make a long story short, the Joker says yes. And it seems like Bruce's feelings are very hurt by this, almost. It was really weird. I'm not sure exactly how to think about it. I mean, they threw in, this is where Kevin Smith started to throw in some potty humor, which was, like you said, it was funny, but it reminded me that Kevin Smith was, you know, writing this book. And I don't know, it just seemed kind of redundant, because he talks about, the Joker's asked, you know, why didn't you let me die? And Bruce talks about, without saying it, he talks about his parents and saying, you know, I've seen death, and I swore to myself that, you know, I would never be responsible for another death if I can help it. I don't know. It seemed like something we've seen before, like over and over again. Didn't seem anything new. It didn't seem like it was even like a really fresh take on it. It just seemed redundant.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess I would give it like a 7 out of 10. It wasn't a bad book. I thought the art was actually pretty good. The writing and the dialogue was good. It didn't grab me, because it seems like it's something that I've already read before.
Yeah, and I could see that. I had a surprise this week, and I've been liking Daredevil throughout the last arc, but I picked up Daredevil number 116, Return of the Kingpin, Part 1. This book was really, really good.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
I read this, and I had no expectation for it. I thought it was okay, this is probably going to be, like, middle of the road good. I was, you know, expecting the usual. I was impressed. And I've never read a whole lot of Kingpin before. Like, I've read the Kingpin arc, you know, the Back in Black Spider-Man story from One More, you know, just before One More Day, mm-hmm. which wasn't all that impressive. And then primarily, a lot of my Kingpin knowledge comes from the old Spider-Man cartoon. So be that as it may.
Yeah, that's pretty good Kingpin, though.
Yeah, and I figured that was like a condensed summary version of the mm-hmm. actual Kingpin. But this is really, like, Daredevil's not even... maybe he's in it for like a flashback panel. But this was just essentially a character study of the Kingpin, and he's in a different country. He's trying to start over. Like, I don't know what happened to bring him to this point, because the last I remember, I thought he was in jail.
No, he got out, his wife died, and his wife kind of set up all this stuff where she wanted him to kind of pay for everything, and it ended up with Matt just saying, you know, you need to leave the country. Mm-hmm. And the Kingpin was basically defeated, and he's gone, and this is the first time we've seen him. And yeah, keep going, because this was good.
He was in a different country, and he went back to somewhere his wife loved, and he met a new girl, and slowly you see he starts to develop a relationship with her and her children, and it's really like, it's really tender-hearted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you can see that like there's moments where he kind of fights his darker urges, but really it's sort of just like he's trying to make a new life for himself. And David Aja's artwork in this was just absolutely gorgeous. And there's the way he lays it out. There's oftentimes there's like three main colored panels on the page, and then on the side of it there's smaller black and white panels that are just characters' faces and their expressions. And it's just gorgeous, and the emotion really comes across on those pages. And they're not even that detailed, which was surprising. And he does it in other ones where there's smaller size, larger panels. And again, it's facial shots, and some of them are sad, and some of them show Kingpin getting angry. And like I said, the emotion is just dripping off the page in those. And it was just a great book. And of course, spoiler alert, we're going to talk about the end here, but it ends in tragedy, and ends in Lady Bullseye and the Foot Clan finding that, I don't know what the hand. they're going to be the Foot Clan. They find the family, and of course are going to drive Kingpin back to who he is. But for just like a single issue character study, and I don't need 5 issues of this,
mm-hmm.
but just for one issue, like, damn, this was really impressive. And then the cover for next issue, which looks like Daredevil and Kingpin teaming up, like, I was really excited. Like, where's this going to go?
Yeah.
But
yeah, this was really good. It's cool because it's great because you know what's going to happen the whole time. I mean, you know that he's going to find this woman, and the best thing about that is that you know he's going to find this woman. You know that he's going to kind of fall in love with her and her kids, and it's going to be taken away from him. And the best part of the book is that you see it all through the Kingpin's eyes, and he also knows this is going to happen. There's a scene where he's going to meet this woman, and he's rushing to her because he's just waiting for the mobster to show up or someone to show up just to kill her. And he gets there, and she's fine. But then... Yeah,
when he's talking about he comes home every night, and he goes faster every night because he's afraid he's going to come home to find something bad. And when he comes home, and she's just like, you know, what's wrong? And it's just a really tender moment.
Yeah, and the stuff that dealt with, like, his rage and his anger, this was good. I mean, this was a character examination of the Kingpin, and this was just great. I mean, like you said, Daredevil really wasn't in this at all, and he didn't need to be.
No. And the thing was, the story, I mean, that type of story, it's not exactly, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, it's not terribly original. Like, you could totally see the ending coming a mile away in this.
Right.
But that's not to discount the quality of it or how well that same story is told. You can tell the same story, you know, in 5 different types of formats or in 5 different ways and, you know, add a flourish to it here. And that's what Brubaker does, and it's still good. It's a really well-versed story, and what it does is it showcases how well Brubaker can take a typical type of story and characters that you know and add new depth to them and then make you interested and keep you glued to the book.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree. I mean, even though you knew exactly what the ending was going to be, like, I still found myself, like, being caught up in it and getting emotional when it actually happened.
Yeah. So I was really impressed. That was definitely a step, like, up in quality, I thought, from The Last Arc. And where I was kind of having a passing interest in Daredevil, like, this... Like, I was like, ooh, I'm actually excited about it now, so...
Yeah, I think it was like an 8.5 out of 10. This was solid. Very solid.
Yeah, I agree. It was 8.5.
War of Kings number 1 came out. So this is kind of the sequel to Annihilation. This is the next cosmic crossover in Marvel, which I used to hate Marvel's cosmic stuff, but it's actually been really good lately. This is... Not much has happened in this one. This is just kind of setting it up, but... what's going on is that Black Bolt and the Inhumans are now in control of the entire Kree Empire. So Black Bolt, after after the Secret Invasion and everything, he decided that the Inhumans can't be... They have to be more proactive in what they're doing. They can't just wait for people to attack them. They need to kind of start going out and just being dominant. And they were actually made by the Kree. So Black Bolt takes it upon himself to go back and basically take over the Kree Empire. On the other hand, Gabriel Summers, Vulcan, who is Scott and Alex's brother, he has become the Emperor of the Shi'ar Empire. So what's going on is, you see it from an outside view, it's just kind of like two warring nations are building up their power, and you know what that's going to lead to. So issue number one has to do with Crystal, who's one of the Inhumans. She's getting married to Ronan the Accuser, who was the champion of the Kree. And Vulcan is taking it upon himself at this point to strike the Kree and to start this war off. So all this really was this kind of one first initial strike and a battle sequence. But I have to give it to Marvel and to Abbott and Lenning, because this, even though I don't really know a lot of this stuff and I'm kind of picking it up for the first time, but this seems big. Like, this seems like an epic intergalactic war book. They go in with this, the Shi'ar go in with this very precise strike, and of course their plan is to take out Black Bolt first and then to kind of get out of there. And they actually do it. And so it kind of ends with this last page of Medusa talking through Black Bolt, and Black Bolt just, and his clothing is tattered and he's just been roughed up, and talking about how they're going to pay in blood. And I was shocked by how much I actually felt it. I was like, wow, this is a big deal. And it's great because there's always the idea of the reader perspective about what's the best kind of crossover, because we want this big kind of epic crossover, but a lot of people don't want something that you're gonna have to read every single book, you know, to understand. And that's exactly what this is. Like, they're taking this, they're putting this crossover out in space. That way it has absolutely nothing to do with the actual Marvel Universe. None of the books are gonna tie into it, but still in its own self-contained world, it's a big deal. So this is definitely a great book. I wasn't sure if I was going to finish the series, but I'm actually going to add it to my box after reading this first issue. This was like a 9 out of 10, just very solid.
Okay. Did you read New Avengers: The Reunion number 1?
I did. Yes, I did.
I liked it. It was good. It didn't blow me away, but it's only a first issue, and what it did is it got me interested in the series. Right. And there were a couple of things I really liked about this book, and I guess that's the way I could sum it up. Overall, the book was like good, but there were pieces of it that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that, yeah, I feel the same way.
One of those pieces was the conversation between Clint and Bucky.
Oh yeah, that was good.
And you know, of course, this is the first time, you know, they've talked before in Captain America, and you remember the Fallen Son issue where Tony was going to offer the position of Captain America to Clint, and he turned it down. Well, this is the first time we actually get the two of them kind of bickering, and they're both fairly strong personality people, and Clint, they get in a little argument, and there's a pause, and Clint's like, you know, I could have been Captain America. I thought for a second he was just going to like turn around and punch him, because I was like, oh, it's kind of a blow. But I like that they finally brought that up, and there's, you can definitely tell there's like a begrudging respect between them, even though they do bicker. And that's actually, from what I've heard, that's kind of how him and Steve kind of were in the
beginning. Yeah.
Like, they,
yeah,
he respected him. They didn't necessarily agree on everything, but so I thought that was a good moment. And then what the story does is it follows Clint as he tries to keep up with Mockingbird while she's off doing a secretive mission on her own, and her reasons for it are kind of her own, and she's not letting Clint on in it or telling him what's going on. But the whole aspect of it is, can Clint get her back? Like, yeah, it's his wife, and he still loves her. And what he wants to do is kind of pick up right where they left off. And then, you know, she died, and technically she's not his wife anymore due in legal process, but he says like he doesn't recognize it, you know, that wasn't her that died, and so technically he believes they're still married. And what she does is she's a different person now. She's gone through experiences and they've spent enough time apart that she can't just go right back to where they were. And I totally can relate to that in like a relationship that I had in the past. And like I totally know that thing where you're apart for a while and then you try and get back together and it's not the same. Mm-hmm. even though you really, really want it to be like you're one person's different and one person's the same, or maybe you're both different. And no matter how much you maybe try and recapture that magic, you just can't, at least initially in this book, they can't. And, you know, it's going to go off on 3 more issues and we'll find out. And I'm sure eventually there's going to be some getting back together between the two of them. But, I totally like that hit home a little bit for me. I was like, that's pretty damn good. So I like that they're exploring that aspect and setting up that tension between them.
Yeah. The only issue I would have with this book, and it's not really the fault of the book, is that I don't really find myself interested in the Mockingbird character. And I feel like I almost feel like I haven't got enough backstory, and I feel I maybe, well, obviously we're going to get more. But I don't know. I'm just not feeling it. To be honest, I thought the best part of this book was the interaction between Clint and Bucky, which, you know, should not have been the case. And I think that that's just my personal preference, just because I haven't found myself that attracted to the Mockingbird character. But I'm definitely going to read the series. I thought it was good, not great. I thought the art was good. I'm just not sure where this is going. I'm hoping it's going to be more than just where the relationship is. I'd like to see more of like who Mockingbird is now, because there was some interesting stuff about how she doesn't know anything. You know, she was taken by the Skrulls, and the Skrulls were shapeshifters. She has really bad trust issues. She doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't know who she is, and it looks like she's kind of trying to figure that out, and she's kind of acting out to do that, which I find interesting. I have no idea where the series is going to go.
Yeah, and I like that they mentioned, like, she was an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., and she had all these different types of occupations, but she's really trying to find out who she is. And, yeah, I get what you're saying, like, the issue just didn't grab you right away. And it might take a little while for it to get rolling a little quicker, but I'd give it a 7 out of 10. I thought it was a good, you know, better than, slightly above average book.
Yeah, I'd probably get the same thing. Because like reading it, it was a solid book. It just didn't grab me. And I mean, it's only for the first issue, so we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Last book I want to talk about. I've been picking up. Well, actually, what got me started is the on my iPhone, I was downloading the Proof comics, and they had the first 3 issues on the iPhone format. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. I'm kind of interested in the concept because I like cryptozoology, and it's set in the Northwest, and I live in the Northwest, so I was like, well, this could be cool. And so I started downloading those, and I liked the electronic format. It made it really easy. It was very, very intuitive and easy to read, and I thought it was really well done. But I could only get the first 3 issues, and I was really hooked after those first 3 issues. So I went out and I bought the trades. And for those that don't know, Proof is about basically a really secretive faction of the government that involves itself in matters of cryptozoology. So, like, things like the chupacabra and animals that you hear about that aren't supposed to exist, but there's legends that they do, Loch Ness Monster, things like that, are what's investigated in this book. And Sasquatch is actually an agent of the FBI. Like, they call him John Proof, and he's a pretty interesting character in the way he interacts with humans, and he's the only one of his kind that he knows of, and his whole thing is he's trying to find more of his kind. And I bought the first 2 trades, and they were really good, so I've switched to issues now, and it didn't come out last week. I think it came out the week before, but Proof 17 came out. And what it did is the first arc of the book was about the Chupacabra, and what that was doing was it was a beast. It might have been related to Proof, but what it does, it's much more animalistic, I guess, and it wears people's skins and masquerades as other people, and that's how it moves around, kind of like a hermit crab would. And so what it's doing is it's killing people, and so they have to go investigate it, and they end up bringing it back to this government compound where they keep all these different types of species that can't interact out in the wild anymore because of human encroachment. So things like fairies and all these kinds of little really odd creatures. But it's pretty fascinating. What it is it looks like the Chupacabra is cooking something up to break out of the compound. And so what it does, it's going to kick something off. And she has some kind of relationship to Proof. And what that does, this issue kind of sets it up, and we're going to see more of that as it goes on. But I've really been enjoying this book. This issue itself was, it was okay. It was a 7 out of 10 book, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it's kind of creepy in a way, but also it gives you these little factoids throughout the book as well, which are really interesting for me. So one thing I really love are like the History Channel shows or National Geographic shows when they're like hunting, you know, monster catchers or things like that. And so what this book essentially is, it's like a fictional version of that. And it's kind of humorous too, the way the characters interact with each other. It's very natural and pretty good. And so I really enjoyed it. I'm having a lot of fun with this book.
One book that I wanted to touch on real quick that came out a couple weeks ago was the latest issue of X-Factor. Now, the last time we talked about X-Factor, I was telling you about how Jamie had a baby and he accidentally absorbed the duplicate of the baby into him, and Siren, who had the baby, was trying to kill him. And this was all stuff that Peter David, the writer, did not want me to talk about. Peter David, the writer, in the recap page at the very beginning, said, please don't spoil this. I have a problem with that just because I feel like by telling people, it's going to make them want to read it. I think he's under the assumption that we should just say, hey, big things are happening in X-Factor, check it out. But no offense to Peter David, I'm going to spoil the latest issue yet again. So if you don't want it spoiled, pause the podcast now.
Yeah, it's been almost a week since it came out, so.
Yeah, it's been about 2 weeks now. So if you don't know, then the big thing that happened is that a while ago in X-Factor, we saw that Jamie had sent a deuce of himself out in the world to learn new knowledge, and then when he would absorb the dupe back, he would actually gain that knowledge. But the problem that he had is that a lot of his dupes were taking on lives of their own, and they didn't want to come back. And one of the standalone issues dealt with the fact that he found out that a duplicate of his had become a minister, was married, and had a child. And so Jamie had to make a decision if he was going to reabsorb that dupe or just let him live his life, and he decided to let him live his life. So with the fallout of all the stuff with the baby, we see that it's a couple weeks later, and he goes to seek this dupe out. And the reason why he goes to see this dupe is the dupe has a child, and he basically tells him, hey, I'm not sure if you know, but that child isn't yours because you can't have a baby. If you have a baby, it's just a dupe, so it cannot be yours. And there's a really touching moment where the duplicate's like, yeah, I know it's not mine. He's like, that's a personal, you know, something personal that I've had to go through. That's something between me and my wife, but I do know that. So it starts getting pretty intense, and it looks like Jamie is going to the dupe to either kill himself or to try to have the dupe kill him. And towards the end, you hear a voice telling Jamie that he's not going to kill himself and that that's not the way that things are planned. And you turn around at the very end of the issue, you see a much older Layla Miller, and she is now back in the Marvel Universe.
They don't say how.
It just ended with her. It was very cool the way they pulled it up, because you hear this voice kind of tell him, you know, you're not going to do this. And Jamie's like, well, how would you possibly know that? And you see her face, and she's like, because I know stuff. And she's aged quite a bit. She's either in her 20s or 30s, or, you know, somewhere around the same age that Jamie would be.
Because they were together, weren't they?
Well, that was the thing, that Layla as a teenager always said that her and Jamie end up getting married. She still has her M tattoo that she got in the future. So I don't know. It was very cool. I think that was something that X-Men fans, X-Factor fans have wanted back for a long time, because that was something that was really unresolved in Messiah Complex. So anyone who was interested in X-Factor before or liked Messiah Complex, you might want to start picking up X-Factor now, because with Layla coming back, some good stuff's probably going to happen.
So what we want to do, we've both been playing Street Fighter 4 lately since it came out, and we wanted to give our impressions of what we thought of the game so far. David's much more of a gamer than I am, and so you're going to get two... Well, we'll see if they're different opinions, but David, you really like the fighting game genre.
I am a fighting game guy. Yes, I am.
And Street Fighter 2, this came out... Street Fighter 2 came out when we were, like, just the right age for it. It sucked up a lot of quarters for us, so...
Oh, yeah.
We both have it on the... Did you buy it on PlayStation 3 or Xbox?
I actually bought it on the Xbox just because I would like the controller better on the Xbox.
Okay. So why don't you give your opinion first?
My opinion of Street Fighter 4 is... I don't know. I think it's a good game. It's not a great game. I think it shows a lot of promise, but I feel like, and I think this might be a difference between your opinion and mine, I feel like it lacks depth. I think on the surface, this is an awesome fighting game, an awesome, awesome fighting game, and it's really brought the franchise back. But going into the deeper mechanics of a fighter, I find this game being lackluster when going into the fine-tuning of it. A couple examples of that would be, I feel like the characters aren't really balanced. They've made some changes to the characters, and this is where it's going to go into, like, I am a pretty hardcore fighting guy. I've had almost all the Street Fighters. And I understand what they've done. So they've kind of made Ryu more powerful, but slower. They've made Ken quicker, yet weaker. The only problem is that there are a lot of characters in the game that don't level up. Like, Sagat is probably by far the most dominant character in the game. To fight Sagat is a feat, especially if you're using certain characters. So I think that was very frustrating from my view. Another thing I found very frustrating is that each character only has one super combo and one ultra combo. Where in the various Street Fighter Alpha games, there's at least 2 to 3 combos per character. So I just find it very repetitive. So if I'm doing a combo, I only have one option, when before I would have a couple different options at my disposal. So I find my fighting techniques and my strategy is very limited because I only have certain moves that I can now perform. So that's where I'm coming from. I on the surface, I love the game. I love it. But going into the balance and going into the fine-tuning, I'm a little disappointed.
Okay. Now I'm a much more casual gamer. And really, the reason I didn't even buy this, my girlfriend bought this game. Because she loves Street Fighter 2.
And that's a good woman.
She loves to kick my ass at it. I don't play a lot of fighter games, but I did play Soul Calibur 2 a lot, and I really like that game. And what stood out to me on this was there's a huge difference between the 2D and the 3D fighting genre. And as pseudo 3D as some of the backgrounds get and things like that, this is still very much a 2D fighting game. And so I had to contend a little bit with that, which, and that's just what Street Fighter is. So that's like, I kind of just have to deal with that. But I think it's a beautiful game. I think the graphics are done extremely well. The new characters I haven't played around with this as much, but they do feel a little slightly imbalanced as far as some feel real powerful. It's almost like they tried to just make them so too flashy so people use them and just stick to their favorites. But and typically, like, I'm a button masher guy to the end, and I've been painstakingly trying to learn moves to characters, and so I think this game's actually built a little bit more towards the casual gamer, to where things are fairly easy to pick up, and you can learn the combos fairly well. And so to that effect, I liked it. There were a few goofy things. The story mode, which is only loosely a story mode, but single player, but they have these anime cutscenes that just don't need to be there.
They don't make any sense.
They really are awful. It's so bad. And they try and infuse the game with like a bit of like human drama. And the only character I played all the way through with was Ken. And you find out like he has a wife and a baby, and apparently his wife is Guile's sister. And like there's all this backstory, and it's like I don't care about any of this. Like these are two-dimensional fighting characters. Let them be two-dimensional fighting characters. So like you don't need to infuse any reality into the situation. But if anything, it made me laugh. But I was like, that just doesn't need to be there. But I thought it was very good. I thought it was good for someone like me who's coming back to it. So I haven't played Street Fighter games since Street Fighter 2. So I thought it was enjoyable. I thought it was like an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I would probably give it like a 7 out of 10. I definitely think if you're a fighting game fan or an old school Street Fighter fan, you should pick this game up because you'll love it. I just think that my views of it are... The lower score comes from less from it being a Street Fighter game and more of it being a fighting game. If I was just judging it on being like a Street Fighter game being back, I would give it a higher score. But from playing games like Soul Calibur and then playing games like Tekken 5, this game doesn't compare in terms of the fighting game mechanics. It has good online good online mode. It's definitely a fun game. But it's just, I was just a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, what it did make me want to do is go pick up Soul Calibur.
So, yeah.
Because I really enjoyed Soul Calibur 2, I just haven't picked up Soul
Calibur. Tekken 6 comes out later this year.
Do they have the bear still?
They have a bear.
Oh, I love the bear.
And by the way, for our listeners out there, one of the only things that could potentially ruin our friendship between Eric and I is us playing a fighting game together. Because while I am so seasoned and so hardworking and try to use all my combos, he will use one move and destroy me, and it kills me. It kills me like nothing else.
It's going to be like the button masher move that he just can't get out of, and I'll pin him in a corner. I'll do whatever I got to do to take him down.
It's not funny. It is not. It's infuriating.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So, what was thankfully not infuriating about my weekend was Friday night, me and some friends went to go see The Watchmen. And this review is fully for people who have read the book. So, we're going to be talking about everything that happens. You know, to start off, okay, I watched the movie, and I came out, and I honestly didn't know what to think at first. I was like, well, I think I liked it, but there were things that didn't sit... You know, there were things that stood out, and I was like, okay, I just kind of need to digest that and think about it a little bit more. And I went home and woke up the next day, thought about it. Like, I was investing a lot of time in this. And at the end of the day, I was like, you know, for the most part, I really enjoyed that movie. It was 2 hours, 40 minutes, and at not one point do you stop and look at your watch thinking, God, this is a long movie. It was a really enjoyable experience, and of course, as far as all the reviews go, it was damn near a shot-for-shot remake of the book, as much as it could be. There were parts left out just because they had to compress the story into a little bit. Seeing that, and this is why I had some faith in Zack Snyder before, because with 300, you know, that was the closest thing that I've ever seen to the page being translated onto the screen. And so I thought, well, if he stays that literal to the translation with Watchmen, it can't go off the rails that much. And I was right for the most part. The parts that did deviate from the book, such as the opening credits scene, which the opening credits scene was spectacular. It's set to Bob Dylan's "The Times They Are Changing," and what it does is it gives the history of the Watchmen universe and the Minutemen of the 1940s, and kind of the political ramifications of the superheroes throughout the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And going into where we'd see them in the 70s and 80s later throughout the movie. And it was really well done. The biggest change to the movie was the squid at the end. They don't use the squid, and what they do instead was... And actually, I thought this idea worked out pretty well. Whereas in the book, Adrian Ozymandias, he to unite the world from and bring them back from the brink of nuclear war, he creates a biological life form, which basically looks like a large squid, and teleports it to New York City, where it dies and unleashes a massive amount of destruction upon New York. And people would the world would start to think that this was an alien invasion and band together, very much like Independence Day. And what they did in the movie was basically he takes technology that he'd been developing with Dr. Manhattan, and he basically unleashes explosions related to Dr. Manhattan's powers in different cities throughout the entire world. And he turns Dr. Manhattan into kind of a pariah that the rest of the world would fear. And he basically frames Dr. Manhattan and unites the world against him. And while that alienates Dr. Manhattan already, the story was already set up for Dr. Manhattan's leaving of Earth and his growing alienation with them already. So I thought that was actually a really well done point. And I've seen some reviews being like, well, it just doesn't make sense why they turn away from Dr. Manhattan all of a sudden. And I think it actually does, because even though Dr. Manhattan was a weapon of the U.S. for so long, it was apparent in the media and things how he was growing further distant from humanity, and it would be understandable if he had just zapped New York or something like that. It would be a little bit more skeptical, but he zapped various cities throughout the entire world, and so it does look like Dr. Manhattan is taking his rage out on humanity. Now, that being said, there were inclusions that didn't need to be there that seemed like they were just there for the fanboys, which, like, Bubastis, which is Ozymandias' genetically altered lynx tiger. Mm-hmm. And there's absolutely no reason for it to be there in the movie, because in the comic, it's that character's or it's a byproduct of the genetic testing that was done that would eventually end up with the squid monster. And Bubastis was an early result of that Adrian kept as a pet. And so if they weren't doing the genetic testing in the movie, there's absolutely no reason for it to be there, and they don't explain it. And so, you know, for the people I was with who'd never read the book, they were like, well, what was with that? And I was like, I know, it was, you know, ladies and gentlemen, for your entertainment, a big horned tiger. But for the most part, it was done really well. I thought the music choices throughout the movie, it was all very, I mean, it really felt like the 20th century throughout, like, the 80s and 70s and things like that. I thought the music was done really well. I thought the set pieces were done really well. It does look very much like a little literal translation to the screen, and it is a dark, you know, vision of what might happen if superheroes had existed throughout the 20th century. To that point, I thought it was pretty well done. And what I'm really excited to see is in June, when the director's cut comes out, I want to see what it was, you know, what is going to be added back in. There's definitely things that they had to leave out, and it was unfortunate they had to leave out some things such as, and these were things that were instrumental to the Under the Hood book inserts and things like that, but that stuff's going to, some of that, the Under the Hood stuff is going to come back in on bonus DVDs and the director's cut and things like that, but for having to condense it down into the certain time frame that it was, I thought it was a really well done effort, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay. All right.
So I know you didn't enjoy the book all that much, so you're not going to see the movie.
Yeah, I was debating it, but and nothing against it. It's just, I know I'm not going to like it. I'll probably rent it when it comes out, but given the fact that I really did not have a lot of fun with the book, I just don't see myself liking the movie.
Yeah, and it's to be fair, it's not a fun book. Like, you know, the bad guy basically wins in the end.
Yeah, it was interesting, too, because a lot of people down at school, they went to go see it, not having no idea what it was about, and they kind of came back, and a lot of people, pretty much everyone who I've talked to who has never read the comic, hated it.
Really?
And I'm like, yeah, and I could understand that, because first of all, they have no idea what they're getting themselves into. They just kind of think that they're going to see a superhero movie. And I'm like, yeah, it's like, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah. And there's a lot going on that it's hard if you haven't read the book to understand everything.
Yeah. See, I would think that going in, I mean, I know I didn't like the book all that much, but I can see myself, if I did not like or read the book, I could see myself not hating it, but just being like, what's going on. What about, so you went with people who never read it. What did those people think overall?
For the most part, they liked it. They their reaction was they were able to keep up. I had to explain a few holes in the plot, but for the most part, the way the intro was set up, and they understood how the world worked in the Watchmen universe, and that was something that Zack Snyder actually did fairly well. Was he, without the under the hood excerpts and things of that nature, just through some of the flashbacks that they did keep in the film, you did get a sense of who these characters were, how flawed they were, and how they also all relate to each other. And sometimes it beat you over the head with it a little bit, but you know, some of them thought it was a little goofy. Some of them thought it was good. They were definitely entertained by it. Like I said, none of them were looking at their watches or anything like that. The one thing that was kind of funny is the costumes do kind of lend it to looking a little silly, because, you know, the Night Owl thing and the Ozymandias thing, they do look like something out of it, the Schumacher films. And mm-hmm. to a point, that's totally valid, and that's what it's trying to relate to, is because it's a deconstruction of superheroes. And what kind of superheroes have we seen on screen? Well, we've seen Schumacher costumes and things like that. So I totally understand why they picked those to be in The Watchmen. But it was just kind of interesting to see that.
Right. So was Rorschach, I mean, was he the breakout character, or was it kind of even?
Rorschach was fantastic. The actor who played him just nailed him. And it was actually, he came off actually a little bit, I felt more realistic in the movie. You know, he still had that brought in, and it was word for word, almost dialogue from the book. But for some reason, there was a little bit more human emotion in it, and it was just a spot-on portrayal of it. The one thing I had a little hard time warming up to was Dr. Manhattan, and the guy who plays him had a very understated voice and a very soft voice, and there's no special effects to make him sound any more spacey or anything like that. And for a minute, you know, with just the pure visual of him, you expect him to sound either, you know, large and booming, or have this big kind of Darth Vader-y voice or something. And when it's just like this soft man's voice coming out of him, it's a little different, but at the same time it works because of just who he is, how he's growing apart from reality. Like he doesn't get emotional about anything anymore. And so it's understandable that he has this really calm, soft-stated demeanor. And the one person who did stand out is in the book, Dan Dreiberg, the Night Owl, or the second Night Owl, always kind of irritated me a little bit. Like, he was just, you know, he was the everyman, but he was just, and I totally get the character. Like, he's aging, he's flabby, and, you know, he's the Blue Beetle archetype, basically. And in the movie, the actor who portrayed him did an excellent job of making him believable and interesting, someone who you wanted to root for and follow. And he did a fantastic job. There was little like inflections of a comic tone in his voice and stuff, so you could actually really get behind him. And so I thought those three characters really stood out far above most of them.
Nice. So overall, what would you rate it if you could?
I'd give it an 8.5 out of 10. I really enjoyed it. It was a packed theater up here. I haven't been to a premiere like this, and I've gone to premieres, you know, of big movies, you know, since the Star Wars prequels, but this, I haven't seen a preview this big since we went and saw Episode 3, which was a line.
Did you see it at Cinerama?
Yeah, and this was the first line since then that I'd actually, it wrapped around the outside of the building, like down the block, around, you know, around the street corner. And that, you know, and I got there an hour beforehand, and I was still down the block around the street corner. So yeah. it was something. It was an experience, and it was fun. The audience, I had a really good audience. The audience laughed and clapped. There was one jerk in the audience who was laughing at inappropriate moments, but but for the most part, like, everyone, you know, clapped during the previews and was fairly attentive during the movie. It was a pretty decent movie going experience.
Nice.
So, and to be fair, I do need to see it again. Like, it took me a couple readings of The Watchmen to truly appreciate it, and I think that's what's going to take with this movie, too. I want to go back, and I want to catch more of the Easter eggs, and I just want to absorb it again just to get everything. So, yeah, 8.5 out of 10. I enjoyed it. It's definitely going to be something I'm looking forward to when the extended director's cut comes out, the 3.5 hour long opus. So that'll do it for us this week, and hopefully we'll be back next week with more comic reviews and TV show reviews and just reviews in general. So if you have any questions, you can email us at contact@fanboystrikeback.com. You can also go to our website at www.fanboystrikeback.blogspot.com, and that is where we have our comic forums link, and we love to see you on there. We have topics set up for discussion as far as TV shows, video games, comic books, just general interest type stuff. We're on there. Love to see you come on, post a topic. We'll talk about things we don't get to talk about on the podcast. So from there, you can find us on most podcatchers.
Yep. iTunes, Podcast Alley. If you do like the show, please leave us a review. Really helps us out with exposing new people to the show. And you can also give us a call on our voicemail, 206-350-2354. Give us a call, leave a comment. If you have a question, we'll play it on the show. We'd love to hear from you guys. And like Eric said, come by the forum. You can post stuff on anything there. There's a lot of video games that are coming out. Street Fighter just came out, Killzone 2. I believe Resident Evil comes out at the end of this month, or end of this week, which I'm very excited about. So yeah, you can just go and post anything there. And then we'd also like to thank InStockTrades.com. They are a great sponsor of our show. They are a great, great website. Trades that are usually around 35% off or more. So you could, like Eric said, proof is pretty good. You probably can check out some proof trades there. Mm-hmm. I've been making a list of trades to get at the Emerald City Con, which is, what, 3 weeks away?
Yeah, it's going to be early April.
Getting excited. Very excited.
I've been making my list as well. I'm really, really looking forward to that trip.
It's going to be a good time. I'm giddy. I talk to my wife about it every day. I'm pretty sure she's sick of it already.
Yeah, it's going to be good times. But like David was saying, in-stock trades, especially if you're looking for the Absolute Editions and Omnibus and big hardcover mm-hmm. books, that is really the place to get them, because you cannot beat the deals that they will have on the website there.
All right, well, that does it for us this week, and we will see you guys later.